I'm Dr. Brian Goldman, host of the CBC podcast, The Dose. Each week, we answer health topics in a smart and sometimes counterintuitive way you won't hear anywhere else. Like, what's the least amount of exercise I can do to get the benefits? Which psychedelics can improve my mental health? And how can I check for cancer if I don't have a family doctor? Top experts help me bring you what you need to know in plain language in about 20 minutes. Find The Dose on the CBC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is a CBC podcast.
Hi, I'm Nora Young. This is Spark and our special series, The Butterfly Effect. A central idea of chaos theory is that changes to initial conditions of a system will affect its outcomes. There's a classic metaphor for illustrating this. Something as small as a butterfly flapping its wings on one side of the ocean can lead to a tornado on the other side. In other words, a seemingly minor action can set a system on a massively different course of events. And that's what we're focusing on in this series. Over the course of 10 episodes, we'll look at small inventions that have gone on to change the world. So much so that it's hard to imagine what life would be like without them. Welcome to The Butterfly Effect. Tell me, what do these three things have in common?
Hold it.
This revealing scene in the classic film Dial M for Murder?
What's he doing?
He's wondering why that key doesn't fit.
This symbolic gesture.
Of Drake with Mayor John Tory, about to present the rapper and singer with the key to the city.
And
there's a magnet on the key.
The trend of escape rooms.
Yeah.
Well, they're all part of what we'll be unlocking today on The Butterfly Effect, the historical, social, and cultural impact of the humble lock and key.
The first locks didn't really have keys. I'm Skylar Town. I study the history and anthropology of security technologies.
He's also an American lockpicking champion.
Twice.
And he's not the only expert lockpicker on today's show.
My name's Lee Honeywell. I'm the co-founder and CEO of Tall Poppy. We do personal cybersecurity for companies and individuals. It's like an intensely physically enjoyable task to pick a lock. I've often compared it to knitting in that it has that sort of like enjoyable tactile element to it. It's very like calming and meditative. It's just you and the little piece of metal. You're trying to outsmart this like little piece of metal that really shouldn't be able to outsmart you. And yet, here we are.
A lot of what makes me a good anthropologist and historian of these technologies is the fact that I know them in a way more intimate than a lot of other historians of technology are able to know their subjects. I wouldn't be a historian if I hadn't had this love for the locks.
People use the physicality of locks as almost this like metaphor for how we think about security in a broader context. And so it really made sense to get familiar with that physical object first if we're going to be using it as a metaphor.
We'll hear more about the cybersecurity side of things with Lee in a little bit. But first, here's Skylar with a pocket history of the lock and key.
There's this really important precursor technology, the door seal, that really followed the through line of the lock for the rest of its history. The way the door seal worked is you shove a peg into a wall, and that peg makes sure that a bolt can't be pulled and a door can't be open. So all you have to do is pull the peg out, but they would wrap the peg with a clay seal. They would mark that seal with intricate characters or designs, and then they would know at the very least that if somebody shattered the seal, that they at least knew that there had been trespass. That peg was the shikatu. The cool thing is that we have this linguistic through line into the next technology, which is the key-based pin lock, very often called the Egyptian lock, though really we are talking Mesopotamia, Assyria, and then that technology is borrowed by the Egyptians and Romans and so on. But again, the cool thing is that the word for the pins in the lock is shikatu. Now, remarkably, that lock, that pin lock that we see in Assyria, Egypt, Rome, throughout the Roman Empire, in fact, was, after the fall of the Roman Empire, just kind of forgotten about by the European world and really fell out of most Western knowledge. The Greeks and the Romans had a different locking concept. Obviously, they borrowed this pin technology that was very present. We have keys from Pompeii, in fact, that were well-preserved that are clearly for pin locks. But now we also have the very beginnings of what will eventually become lever locks. This very simple idea where you have a bolt that's behind a door. So now the bolt is no longer on the outside of the door. All you need is access to the bolt. So they would have a small hole. You would put a stick through the hole. You would put it into the bolt and you would pull the bolt back. But anybody can find a stick. So before there were wards and levers and all the other things that eventually get developed, all they would do was put the hole really far away from the stick. Eventually, those keys, which are enormous, and you can, in so many ancient texts, very popularly the Bible, people talk about having keys slung over their shoulders. And as more people needed locks, and as more people needed access to more than one lock in their life, just functionally they had to get smaller. So that line of engineering starts to develop keyways, so really complicated shapes instead of just a hole that a stick could go in. Or there's a piece of metal sitting in between where the hole is that you put your stick and where the bolt is. And remarkably, that core idea of there always just being a stick in the way and you need to move it remains the core of mechanical security to this day. The pin lock winds up coming back into the European consciousness around 1798, when Vivant Denin, one of Napoleon's court de savants, is traveling with him as he's attempting to conquer Egypt, and discovers this carving of the Shikatu lock, the pin lock, on the wall of a temple, and realizes that it's the same lock that he's looking at all over the place. So he publishes his travelogues, they become very popular in England, where this parallel evolution of a different locking technology has been really blowing up. So in the 1770s, you see Robert Barron create the first of what we call the double-acting tumbler. This is a really important innovation, and watching this be presented, this other guy, Joseph Brahma, is looking at the double-acting tumbler and says, man, that thing is fantastic. Here are some things that I might do if I were pursuing that. The Brahma safety lock is phenomenal. It comes out in the 1780s. He has the concept for it well before the machine tools exist to make it, such as the precision of it. He offers a bounty for anybody that can pick it. It does, in fact, get picked relatively quickly. Learning from that experience, he improves the lock, puts it up in his shop window again, and it goes unpicked for 65-ish years.
And is that the great lock controversy of 1851?
That's the great lock controversy of 1851. So Chubb and Sons create a really clever detector lock based on the lever mechanism that Barron had invented. And then an American, A.C. Hobbs, he had been picking locks all over America. When he gets over to England, he very quickly picks one of the Chubb locks. So then he had to pick the Brahma, the challenge lock that had been in their window for 60-something years. Multiple people had tried to pick it, tried to claim that prize before, and had failed. And just to give you a sense of how certain the idea of perfect security was to everyone in the scene, he was given 30 days to pick the lock. In the end, it took him 52 hours over the course of 16 days. He had to build new tools just to pick it. He effectively had to make a key for the system, but he still opened it. And even though it took that long, it created this huge sort of crisis of conscience. What we see in the patent record from before that moment to after that moment is this explosion after that in new British, in particular, patents, and the American patent record blows up with locks as well at that point.
And so if we jump forward to today, if we think about the typical key that we might have to get into our home, does that key lock system basically work the same way as those older keys and locks?
To a great degree. So the Brahma safety lock remains this very special case. You can still buy a Brahma safety lock. They're one of the only in its original form locks from that period that remains. It's like he was a wizard from the future that just went back and created something extraordinary. But all of these other iterative things that were happening, that Chubb detector lock, and frankly, the Baron double acting tumbler lock, those truly became the lever locks of the modern era, and especially throughout the Commonwealth, as this was the British lock. In America, you have Linus Yale Sr., who takes this idea of the pin lock and perfects it, creates the version of it that we would all recognize with this inline pin tumbler lock. And then his son, Linus Yale Jr., takes this one step further, simplifying it, making a more universal footprint for it. And, you know, Yale in America and Chubb and many other manufacturers in England become these giants of lock making, so that today across the world, you'll find lever locks and pin tumbler locks everywhere. Yale's lock, you can look at one of those locks from sometime between 1800 and 2500 BCE, when that door seal to key lock transition happened, and you can recognize its function as exactly what you're doing with your lock right now. It just uses gravity instead of springs.
So can you give me a quick little bit of a history lesson in the history of digital encryption? Like, how did it come to be invented?
I mean, if we think about the history of digital encryption, we can go back to, and we can go certainly back to the like ancient Caesar ciphers and other kinds of manual types of cipher systems that people came up with over the years. Even stuff as simple as like you make the list of letters and then you add a number to each letter to shift it a certain number of spaces in the alphabet, right? I'm sure we all did that. Maybe not everyone was quite as nerdy as I was as a child, but that was definitely something that like I did in grade 3 with my classmates.
Right.
But you go from there to things like the Second World War. Encryption was like a major strategic battleground in the Second World War.
To the speeding of production, to the winning of the war.
Everything from the Enigma machine, which was like a physical computer, to the early days of vacuum tube computers at Bletchley Park.
Electronics is a science that applies these tubes to the service of man.
And the code breaking that took place there. And then you have this sort of interesting question of like, when you do break the code, can you use the information without revealing that you've broken the code? So, because that was the, you know, they didn't want to let on to the Germans that they'd broken the cipher. So they had to be very selective in like which data that they would act on. So that's always like a really, really interesting question there. And then from the sort of Bletchley Park era, computing power increased massively over the second half of the 20th century. And there was just, you know, this continual arms race of new types of encryption, new mathematical functions being invented.
Are people becoming obsolete? The giant electronic brain is starting cogitating at the university.
And then people figuring out new ways of breaking them. There's sort of two ways to think about the ways that people break cryptography. One of them is that they just apply a lot of computing power to it. And so some of these early crypto systems, it just didn't take that much computing power to overcome them. In other cases, people would find flaws in the way that the mechanical, mathematical functions of the crypto system would work. And that would further reduce the amount of computing that was necessary to break the crypto system. Really, it's just this back and forth of public conversation around like, hey, you know, we're figuring out the next way to encrypt this particular type of data. There's all these like contests and stuff to come up with the next crypto system for different standards. And then people will engage in critique of these crypto systems. And then we will like pick that next version.
I'm Nora Young, and today on Spark, the fifth in our series, The Butterfly Effect, all about the lock and key. My guests right now are anthropologist and historian Skylar Towne and computer scientist and cybersecurity consultant Lee Honeywell. So how does the history of physical locks and keys inform the digital world?
The history of how we talk about locks and locks as part of a security system, I think has a lot to teach us in terms of the sort of digital security debates and policy questions today, there's often been this historical tension between the people who wanted to make locks better by breaking them and the people who were like making the actual locks. And over the years, there's been this sort of back and forth of, hey, you know, how dare you publish information about how to bypass this lock? All that that's going to be able to be used for is to break into people's houses or castles or whatever. And then the other side of that is researchers and instigators are like, well, actually, if we publish this information, everybody can use it to make their systems more secure and better. And if we don't publish the information, then we're just sort of sticking our head in the sand and pretending like, I can't hear you, therefore I must be safe. And that's just, it's just not really true. And we've seen the echoes of this throughout the sort of history of computer security as well, where there's been this debate around disclosing security vulnerabilities and how should that be handled. So whether it's the 1700s and sort of angry letters written to each other in the annals of lockpicking journals versus today on email lists and Twitter, it's the same debate fundamentally.
So people were actually historically having essentially the debates about the ethics of hacking hundreds of years ago.
Pretty much hundreds of years ago. Yeah.
So people frequently use mechanical security metaphors for digital security tools. And there's some fraught stuff there, especially when you take that into legal frameworks. And the crypto wars come and go. There's a lot bad, there's a lot good, some really interesting people. But one of the things that bothered me a great deal is that people would say, you know, you would never find a lock so strong that the government couldn't open it or something like that. But A, would we make it illegal for that to happen? Right? Like, that's the actual question. Because in history, we have had locks that will destroy their contents. We have had locks that can do so much more than what people's basic experience of the lock on their door is. And what people will do is they will take their own fairly narrow experience of that mechanical security and try to map it onto this digital world, especially trying to map it onto managing, administrating, legislating this digital world. And it's a really powerful metaphor for people that mostly only engage with this thing on their door. But the secret is, it isn't the lock on your door that's been keeping you safe for generations, for the most part. But people that have had to engage with truly secure locks and truly secure mechanical security solutions, I think will better understand what cryptographers and those implementing those technologies are attempting to do. Because we don't have the same social norms and safety nets. We don't have the same even threat of law or ability to administrate that law. We don't even have the same footprint of vulnerability. The lock on your door totemizes so many things, but ultimately, someone has to actually walk up to your door to victimize you through that lock. Cryptographers and people working on encryption are trying to protect you in an environment where your attack surface is infinite. No one has to come to your door.
Can you talk to me a bit about how encryption keys are analogous to physical ones?
Yeah. So one of the big debates in cybersecurity today is, should we be allowed to have strong encryption? Encryption that, you know, cannot be bypassed through technical means. So public key cryptography, this idea, you know, when you go to a website and you have the little padlock in the corner of the address bar, that means that your computer and the computer you're speaking to, there's been an exchange of cryptographic information between them that allows you to know that your ISP or whoever else is on the Wi-Fi at the coffee shop you're in, they can't actually see the bits that you're sending across the wire, except in this like encrypted and secure format. Prior to getting that, it used to be you could go to the coffee shop and like steal somebody's Facebook password because they were typing it in. It was just getting sent over the wire. So about 70%+ of the internet is fully encrypted at this point. But if you go to Facebook.com or some other website and you do something bad, Facebook has access to all of the sort of like clear text information that you've posted or done on their website. The alternative is something called end-to-end encryption, where if I want to send you a secure message, I can use an app called Signal, which does this end-to-end encryption sort of key dance back and forth. My phone creates a key, your phone creates a key. They do a type of secure exchange that means that only you and I can talk to each other. The Signal servers can't see what we're talking to each other about. The internet service provider, the cell phone carrier, nobody can see that content except you and I. And this has led to this question of, if somebody uses this kind of strong encryption to commit crimes, now law enforcement can't access that. Is that a problem? It's a very different set of problems from thinking about it as if it was like somebody's front door lock, because we do have this technology that is effectively impermeable. It's not something that can be bypassed through technical means. When law enforcement has needed to seek access to data that has been transmitted over things like Signal, they've needed to either get somebody to snitch, basically, like you can always take screenshots, that there's always that route, or use actual like hacking techniques to break into people's cell phones. It's really like a much, much, much higher bar than what it used to be, which is like sitting in the coffee shop, like sniffing at the Wi-Fi.
Is that the main point of differentiation, or are there other main forms of digital encryption?
Yeah, I think the biggest thing to understand the difference between is when I'm talking to cbc.ca, the people who run cbc.ca, like they know what web pages I'm clicking on, right? Mm-hmm. There's that transparency. Somebody else who's like looking at my internet connection, my cable or DSL provider, like they don't know what I'm looking at on cbc.ca. I could be reading that article about the lady who added raisins to butter tarts, or I could be reading like very serious journalism. My internet service provider doesn't know I have that amount of privacy. Whereas when you have end-to-end encryption, the person that you're talking to, they're the only one that knows what you're talking about, whether it's WhatsApp or Signal. The company running the chat service doesn't actually have access to see your messages. Which brings up a really interesting question is, what if you get spam on these services? Like maybe there are situations in which you want them to see your messages because they're spam, right? So there's actually a whole other protocol there called franking, where I don't know why it's called franking, but it's kind of a funny name. So if I send a message on WhatsApp or Facebook secret conversations mode, which is also end-to-end encryption, and somebody sends me spam via one of these modes, I can flag it as like, hey, this is a spammy message. And that will actually cause it to be able to be visible to the folks that run these services. Otherwise, they can't see what I'm saying.
Hello, I'm Jess Milton. For 15 years, I produced The Vinyl Cafe with the late, great Stuart McLean. Every week, more than 2 million people tuned in to hear funny, fictional, feel-good stories about Dave and his family. We're excited to welcome you back to the warm and welcoming world of The Vinyl Cafe with our new podcast, Backstage at The Vinyl Cafe. Each week, we'll share 2 hilarious stories by Stuart, and for the first time ever, I'll tell you what it was like behind the scenes. Subscribe for free wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Nora Young, this is Spark, and this time we're looking at the long reach of the key, its impact on security, but also how we think about safety, protection, and trespass. I've been speaking to historian Skylar Town and cybersecurity consultant Lee Honeywell. We'll hear more from them both in just a little bit. We were putting together this show, we thought about the evolution of the lock and key, from the physical objects themselves to digital and encrypted forms to a growing trend where the keys to opening or securing just about anything are actually our bodies.
Fingerprint scanners, face scanners, things like that.
Yep, the increasing use of biometrics.
I'm Lily Hay Newman, and I'm a senior writer with Wired Magazine.
As a security reporter, Lily writes on digital privacy, information security, and hacking. So we asked her to walk us through some ways that biometric technology is used as a form of authentication, especially when it comes to the Internet of Things.
If you think about it, you know, all the sensors and devices within your smartphone, those are all little mini computers in themselves. So, you know, if you think about the Internet of Things that way, it's like there are many devices within one computer, and then those same types of sensors are out in the world as separate devices, you know, like CCTVs, routers, you know, televisions, smart TVs, everything is an Internet of Things device or a computer. And more, you know, we're seeing biometrics and biometric authentication deployed across the Internet of Things.
Mm-hmm. I mean, people probably think, for example, of using fingerprints. Can you talk a little bit about some of the more, I don't know, maybe slightly more out there use of biometrics, like iris scans and things like that?
Yeah, there are some really interesting ones. You know, you brought up retinal scans, you know, eye scans. My understanding is that those often aren't deployed in the ways we think of them, like from the movies and things, that, you know, actually a lot of governments and spy agencies and stuff don't really rely on those as much as we think. But it's not unheard of. And I've heard about them being used in industry. And then also there are even more obscure biometrics indicators that researchers have been exploring using over the past decade. Things like the electrical activity of your heart is somewhat unique and can be used as an identifier. It's really, how do I describe it? Like creepy, but also interesting how, you know, anything that's part of us is part of us, you know, and could potentially be turned into something that could be a signal about who we are.
Yes. Welcome to the show. Creepy, but also interesting. So can you talk a bit about some of the benefits of biometric authentication in today's tech?
The huge benefit is that biometrics, by and large, are kind of infallible, right? It can't be swapped out. It can't be, you know, forged, you know, and so that's the whole purpose and what biometrics are trying to kind of get to the heart of, if you excuse the pun, is, you know, this idea of how do we check someone's essence, that they really are who they claim to be, and how do you do it in a way that is easy, right? And where the problems with a lot of other authentication schemes, whether it's something you know, like a password, or something you have, you know, like a physical key, is that you can lose the authentication token, it can be copied, it can be stolen, it can, you know, and so you have to make them more complicated, like strong, you know, long, unique passwords, or, you know, multiple locks on a door. It gets really complicated for people to use. Whereas if they just scan their fingerprint or whatever it is, it's easy to manage.
But what are the implications of using parts of ourselves essentially to secure our personal data on internet connected platforms and technology?
Right. I mean, it's a really important question because there is a bit of a double-edged sword here. That same quality of our innate personhood, or, you know, that we are who we innately should be, having the data about someone's fingerprints or their retinal scan or their heartbeat, if that data is ever compromised, that's sort of like a permanent compromise.
Sure.
You know, these characteristics of us, they are innate and they are largely unchangeable throughout our lives. And if someone can copy that, emulate that, compromise that, it really undermines the protection.
Is there also sort of a trade-off between, or a tension between, privacy and security? I mean, I'm thinking that maybe I don't want a biometric record of exactly everything I've accessed in the same way that I might choose to use cash rather than a credit card, for example.
Yeah. You know, the schemes that have been broadly deployed, things like Apple's Face ID and Touch ID, just as one example, the way these schemes attempt to deal with this issue is the biometric data is stored only on your device. It's not stored in a cloud. That way, not only are you not trusting the company with your data, but you're also not creating a situation where all the users of that authentication scheme, that all their fingerprints or all their biometrics could be stolen at once, you know, by a bad actor. So that's good. And that certainly, I think, was a prerequisite or a requirement for this to be broadly deployed. So it's really important to understand both the steps that are being taken to try to deploy these schemes in a privacy-preserving way, and the reality that in a worst-case scenario of some type of individual compromise, you really don't want your biometrics to ever be exposed. So I think there are major privacy implications, but there are also big security benefits. So it's a complicated one to weigh.
Mm-hmm. Recently, we've seen the breach of password managers like LastPass. Do you think passwords could become a thing of the past as we come up with other forms of authentication in the future?
It would be great. I think we're all ready to be done with passwords.
Yeah.
Two things I would say is, one, that while we all like desperately want this, and we all sort of clearly see the flaws of passwords and, you know, and the problems that have emerged, password-based authentication is so incredibly ubiquitous that
yes.
It's going to take a long time to phase out. It's especially because just sort of the overhead or the cost of deploying it is relatively low, and therefore it'll take a long time for businesses to move away from it. But the other thing I was going to say is that just because we move away from passwords, that doesn't mean we only move towards biometrics, right? There are other ways of doing authentication, including, you know, a sort of new variation or evolution, I think is a better word, that has been standardized now in the industry called passkeys, mm-hmm. which rely on sort of a different scheme related to sort of validating and anointing certain devices of yours mm-hmm. that can again do local storage of cryptographic keys or secrets, and then kind of a process of validation that doesn't involve like a central repository of passwords and checking against that repository on a server, you know, and therefore like drastically reduces the chance that a trove of passwords could be stolen, really reduces the ability for bad actors to conduct phishing attacks and, you know, steal your secrets and break into your accounts, things like that. So yes, we got to move away from passwords, but there are a few options, not just biometrics, to move toward.
Yeah. Are there any other alternatives that you're aware of that seem promising?
Well, I just actually recently wrote an article for Wired reminding everyone that another great authentication mechanism for your most valuable, your most sensitive accounts is to use a hardware authentication token or a hardware key that's often like a thumb drive or, you know, a USB drive that plugs into your computer. And so instead of something you know, like a password, something that's stored in your mind, you know, it's something you have physically, like a door key. You know, if you were managing a key ring of 500 of these thumb drives for all of your accounts, I'm totally recognizing that would not be realistic. But, you know, setting one up to do the authentication on your most sensitive accounts, like your email, your bank account, things like that, it's a really great one that kind of is halfway between, in my mind, something you know, like a password, and something you are, like a biometric. It's something you have.
Mm-hmm. Can we talk a little more specifically about the Internet of Things? Like, what are some of the current security issues when it comes to IoT devices?
Well, some of the big issues with Internet of Things devices actually have to do with how difficult it is to send software updates to those devices and patch the devices. So these are typically low-end devices in the sense that they're, you know, not sold for a ton of money. and, you know, they need to be affordable. So as a result, often companies and manufacturers cut corners on the software development process from a security standpoint, and then also in terms of creating a platform or a mechanism to distribute patches. And so that, you know, it creates problems because if you have a router in your, you know, it's just sitting in your house for 8 or 9, 10 years or whatever, you just turn it on and it, you know, it beams your Wi-Fi around your house and that's it. You know, maybe there's a bunch of really critical security vulnerabilities in that router that could allow an attacker to take it over, control it, conscript it into a botnet, whatever they're going to do. And you never think about updating your router, probably, you know, like you, and can you? And even if there was a mechanism to do it at one point, is the router still supported? Is it still receiving updates? You know, it's, like I said, many of these, many IoT devices are deployed, you know, in the wild for a decade or more. Just kind of a set it and forget it. You know, smart TVs are the same way. So that, I would say, is the absolute, you know, biggest issue, security issue with IoT devices right now. And to, one other that is relevant to authentication is that often Internet of Things devices are deployed with like a default username and password. Yes. Like admin or, you know, password. Exactly.
Right. Yeah.
And, you know, if there's default credentials set for every baby monitor, you know, of a certain make and model or every router, every camera, whatever, attackers can, it's not even hacking. They just know what the login is likely to be, and they can, you know, remotely access the device and then just log right in.
So, and just finally, where do you envision the use of authentication technology going in the not so distant future?
Like I was saying, I think passkeys and as you were alluding to, just the diversification of digital authentication schemes, you know, moving away from passwords, or attempting to do that is the sort of 5-year view or whatever we want to call it. You know, that's just an unspeakably enormous project. And so, you know, I think it's going to really take time. I always go back to the physical analogies. You know, how different are locks and keys than they were in the Middle Ages? Or how different is the lock you use on your locker compared to one someone would use on their locker at school in the, whatever, the 1960s? And from that, I think we can kind of see conceptually there aren't a lot of changes, but in implementation, there are refinements and sort of improvements over the years that make authentication or, you know, unlocking a door easier to implement, because you can build a really, really strong lock, but if the person who's supposed to be able to open it can't do it, it was too strong, right?
Right. Lily Hay Newman is a security reporter with Wired Magazine. I'm Nora Young, and this week on Spark's Butterfly Effect series, we're talking about the history, evolution, and future of how we secure our stuff, physically and digitally. Now more with computer scientist and cybersecurity consultant Lee Honeywell, and anthropologist and historian Skylar Town. I'm also interested in your thoughts on the societal impact of keys and locks. Like, what kind of a social role have they played?
Immense. What locks are, what they have been, from the beginning, is this administrative technology that allows us to have a different style of civilization than we would have without them. Like, that is how significant they are to the social order. The moment that the first door seal was created, the possibility of trespass was codified in some society. The first time they were implemented was a way of saying this is a private space. It might be semi-private. There might be multiple people accessing it. But if you trespass, importantly, there will be a consequence to it. The door seal being this really important first technology on our way to the key-based lock, you can just smash it. Mm-hmm. But the fact that the seal exists at all implies that there is the administrative structure, the legal structure, or at least just the threat of violence or social exclusion that will be carried out. And as a result, that changed how that society worked together.
So I have to ask you, what do you think the world would be like if the lock and key had never been invented?
I've actually been thinking about that question for years, and I don't think it would be recognizable. I think the impact is such that the world wouldn't be different, it would be alien. I think you can look at societies that don't use locks, but they are only mapped onto a society that had a lock to begin with. They're only in response to it. We have no idea what we look like living together without the lock at the core of our society.
What do you see are sort of the main challenges right now in the field of encryption?
I think one of them is these policy questions. In some ways, it feels like we're having this same fight over and over and over again around this idea that, you know, governments should have backdoors in encryption. There's folks who've been around long enough are like, is it 1997 again? Are we really having this fight again? Because it really, in a sort of technical community perspective, it is really a settled battle that you can't have these like intentional backdoors, because it then means that the systems will not be safe for folks like dissidents. The other challenge is less the specific technical properties of the crypto systems, and it's much more the implementation, because there's it's sort of the practice of you design a crypto system and then you actually have to implement it. People inevitably make mistakes in the implementation because we're human beings trying to tell computers how to do things. And computers, you have to imagine, are like very, very literal children. They will do exactly the thing you tell them to do, even if the thing you tell them is wrong. And often in implementing complex mathematical crypto systems, people will make mistakes literally in like typing in the algorithm. And so you're having this sort of constant having to update, you know, install security patches. And many, many years ago, I worked on the team at Microsoft where we were the ones that reboot people's computers on the second Tuesday of the month. Sorry. And fundamentally, that's like a very, very important part of keeping people safe, is getting folks to install that latest security update, getting folks to upgrade to the latest version. I think one of the things that's the most brilliant about the sort of mobile ecosystem is that the way you get people to install security updates is that if they want to get the new emojis, they have to install the security update too, because they're sort of tied together.
So Lee, as you know, we're calling this series The Butterfly Effect and looking at the kind of outsized impacts of seemingly small technologies. What do you think some of the physical lock pioneers in history, like your Jeremiah Chubb or your Linus Yale, would think about the keys we use in the digital space today?
I think they would be fascinated by how those same debates around security through obscurity versus transparency and conversation, that sort of intellectual heritage of openness and conversation, I think would be really interesting to people coming from another time and looking at today. I'm thinking back to the big storm we had in May in Ottawa and surrounding areas. There was power outages for days at a time. And just feeling the sense of relief that, you know, we have quite a bit of smart home stuff in my house, and the way that it's set up is designed to work without the internet. So even when the power was out, we could still unlock the front door and it didn't need to call someone else on the internet to like get it set up. And just thinking, you know, as we're thinking about the sort of unintended consequences of these systems, I think a lot of people are installing, whether it's like smart thermostats or other kinds of smart home devices, how long is the company that it interacts with going to be around? Like, can we actually rely on these systems in a totally offline way? Because, you know, I think about the thermostat at my parents' house that was literally there since the 60s. It's the same device and something like that that has like a little computer chip in it. Not only may it physically not last that long because it's more complicated, but if it calls out to some third-party service, is that company that it's connecting to, how long is that going to be around for?
Mm-hmm. Skylar, almost a decade ago, you made the claim, I think in 50 years, a kid will still know what a house key is.
Ah, I did.
So, yeah. With all the advancements in smart lock technology, biometrics, and all the rest of it, do you still believe in the physical lock and key?
I still do. There are a few reasons for this. One of them is a friend of mine, Jos Weyers. He's an incredible lockpicker in his own right. He's an impressioning champion. And many years ago, he needed to buy a whole lot of locks for the Dutch national grid. And he was looking at mechanical locks, and people kept trying to sell him on the next smart solution, electromechanical something. And he kept insisting he needed to see their mechanical locks. Like, what was their most interesting, newest mechanical lock? And from a lockpicking perspective, he was certainly interested as a hobbyist himself. But he also pointed out to me that there were many situations on their grid that couldn't tolerate an electromechanical lock. There remain communities that are not going to have reliable access to the various features that smart locks are being sold on to begin with. You know, a smart lock is great if you have internet and the phone and all of the things that you need to take advantage of the features of it. I'm sure people are listening saying, well, smart lock X, Y, and Z can still do all of those things without being connected. And if you have a 9-volt in your pocket, you can stick it on the front of it and still operate it and so on and so forth. But all of that sounds like a miserable way to operate a lock. And I actually think that there's some really important cases for them and some things that they solve that are making people's lives a lot better. But the whole deal with the attack surface of smart devices is that somebody doesn't need to be anywhere near you to victimize you, to spy on you with a camera or change the heat in your house or whatever it might be. But if the threat is them walking through that door, they still have to turn the knob. And importantly, the number of times that I, growing up in northern Vermont, freezing cold, didn't have my key getting off of the school bus, and my parents had no way to get a hold of me because it was before cell phones and all that, and they were mortified. So as a result, we always left the garage door unlocked, and I knew how to get in through the trash chute. So, right. You know, the key under the mat, all of those other things can go away if you really have a reliable thing that will open that door every time. So I'm a big believer in the utility of smart locks. At the same time, they're not able to serve every community, and I truly believe that in 50 years, the iconography for what a lock and a key is are going to remain the same.
I spend a lot of time thinking about where we are in the sort of historical moment of cybersecurity. And, you know, at some point in, like, I think the late 1800s, medicine moved past like miasma and realized that there's this like germ theory of disease and people should wash their hands before doing surgery. I feel like that's where we are with computer security, that we've sort of figured out that it's hard to secure computers. We have to be in this sort of continual improvement process. We have to install updates. Manufacturers of software and hardware have to do their due diligence to ship secure products. And there's some really interesting questions around, do we need to have like a product liability process so that if you know, coming back to, if you ship a crappy smart lock and it means that people are locked out of their house, or that people are not locked out of their house, that like people have their house broken into because the smart lock fails open, like, is there a product liability question there? So much of where we are as a field of cybersecurity is really, really, really early days. We're really just defining these like norms and expectations as a field.
There are emerging technologies like quantum keys and other types of encryptions. Are there ways that you expect to see encryption technology evolve in the near future?
I think it's a very easy to bet to say we will continue to have new kinds of encryption come up, new kinds of attacks against those encryption, new bad implementations. The biggest thing, thinking about like what should a lay audience know about encryption, is that there is this like community of practice of folks who have established this like body of knowledge around how to do it right and how to not make obvious mistakes. often the case, I think, in encryption, like in many other kinds of technology, where people will make very, very grand claims about the strength of their system that are not supported by evidence and that are very far outside of the sort of mainstream conversation. And I think it's one of those things where encryption, because it is highly technical, it is highly mathematical, it's not obvious for an outsider to be able to understand. It's easy to get like swept up in the sort of hype cycle. It's very, very easy to build a crypto system that I can't figure out because I'm not a cryptographer. But to build a crypto system that will stand up to scrutiny by other cryptographers, that is the much, much more difficult proposition.
Do you think we could ever have an absolutely 100% unhackable encryption system, even in principle?
I think there's a couple of projects out there around building like provably secure operating systems. To build something that is provably secure requires a really, really high degree of mathematical rigor. And fundamentally, the kinds of systems that you and I use in our day-to-day life, the amount of code that the platform that we're recording this interview on, to write that in a provably secure way would require hundreds of thousands of person hours of effort, because doing that provability stuff is like, it takes a lot of math. And so that bar of like the perfect security, there are systems which can be proven as secure, but the bar is very high and those systems tend to be very small. They do a very small thing.
So there was a lot of hand-wringing about that people had been taught to look on their bunches of keys with a sense of security, that the whole idea of safe as houses was built on the back of the lock. Like all of these feelings of not just losing your stuff, but having this castle, this little bit of personal isolation that is only yours. All of that was tied up in that idea of perfect security. And one of the writers that I loved at the end of the Great Lock Controversy said, you know, the best replacement for the lock on the door is faith in the heart. That perhaps now that we all understand our mutual vulnerability, we will be able to live together in mutual care. And it is such a shift. We no longer believe in the idea of perfect security, and generally believe that any lock can be picked. And there's this level of security ambivalence that definitely crosses over to the digital realm as well, where they're a lot more dangerous from being ambivalent, unfortunately. But there are so many other things that are keeping us safe that the lock created space to do. You know, that not just dream, but reality of perfect security for 65 years. That's the same time that those street lamps got built. That's the same time that England switched from a majority rural to a majority urban population on the back of those locks. And the society that they discovered after the death of perfect security was a society that didn't need perfect security. It had been built underneath that really important layer of the security technology. A really amazing society kind of emerged out the other side. But that lock, that perfect security for the time that it existed, was integral in letting all of those other things develop. And that's sort of my message to those pushing back on encryption. Like what we need right now is we create a robust digital world and digital community in order to have the street lamps of the internet, in order to have the social structures as more and more people join that community as that population booms and we learn how to live together online in safer ways, we need extraordinary security technologies so that in 20 years, in 30 years, when it's finally proven that it can never, ever actually be secure, what we'll find out is that we gave enough breathing room for a safe, secure digital society to establish itself.
Skylar Towne is an anthropologist and historian.
Sorry, I like talking about lockpicking. Your actual question was about if I've learned anything from it.
And Lee Honeywell is a computer scientist and cybersecurity consultant.
You can be like, hey, Nora, is your key signature blah, blah, blah? And you can be like, yep, that's me.
You
You've been listening to Spark. The show is made by Michelle Parisi, Samarie Johannes, Adam Killick, and me, Nora Young, and by Skylar Towne, Lee Honeywell, and Lily Hay Newman. Follow Spark on your favorite podcast app, and you can find us on Facebook and Twitter, where we are Spark CBC. I'm Nora Young. Talk to you soon.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.